I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week are camps. And not the fun camps that have songs about them, movies about them, but rather the concentration of populations that are deemed to be quote-unquote dangerous for whatever reason. These can be anything from political suspects, ethnic minorities, prisoners of war, enemy aliens, or even refugees. And it's the concentration of people that we are seeing more and more of around the world here in 2025. Certainly with the mass displacement of hundreds of thousands and millions of people around the world. And if you look historically, things like slave plantations in the southern United States and the Caribbean to the concentration camps of Nazi Germany, there are remarkable historical precedents for concentrating individuals together. And that is the subject of a new book by Aidan Forth entitled Camps, A Global History of Mass Confinement. And in this book, Aidan goes around the world to look at various forms of camps and mass confinement to identify some of the main themes that go along with these sites. He looks at things like industrial enclosures, things like prisons, workhouses, and labor colonies up through conquest and genocide in the Nazi Empire through to more modern camps like refugee camps, migrant detention camps, and explores how the concentration of people into a confined space affects them as well as the surrounding communities and societies. It's a wonderful book that really goes cross cultures to understand or explore some of the base human emotions that go along with confinement, both in terms of the motivations of those who are confining and the reality of the lived experience for those who are confined. And while, as Aidan is going to talk about on the show, he is not doing necessarily original research into each example. He's pulling from the wonderful research of specialists in each area. He does a great job of bringing it all together under this umbrella of the book to determine and to assess and analyze how these rather ubiquitous enclosures relate to each other and the transnational connections that exists. So it's a wonderful book, and I was very pleased to have the opportunity to talk with Aidan a little earlier. So think you will enjoy this conversation. I know I did. So let's get right into my chat with Aidan Forth. All right. And Aidan Forth joins me now. Aidan, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Really pleased to have you here to talk about Camps, A Global History of Mass Confinement. And to get us started, I'm always curious when we're talking about things that I think we all can picture them and have an idea of what you're talking about. But just so that we're clear, let's start with the definition of a camp and how you are defining these, because across the board, across countries, across regions, across times, they look different in different places. So how did you, in approaching this topic, approaching the book, come to define the term camp?
Yes, well, thank you so much for the question. And it's actually a deceivingly simple question, because it was quite difficult to come up with a definition that would encompass the vast variety of episodes of confinement and violence that you see in this book. The book ranges over 200 years. It goes to every inhabited continent. And in many ways, the point of the book is to show the sheer diversity of what we have called over time camps. One way to define camp is sort of historical and subjective. So if historical actors at the time called something a camp, well, it was a camp. But as a social scientist, I think it is useful to have a more kind of objective definition. On page two, I define a camp put simply as a demarcated institution that defines categories of people. They could be enemy aliens, racial minorities, social outcasts, and confines them as a preventive measure, often in a moment of perceived emergency. So in, say, a war or during a revolution or an economic crisis or something like that. So that's sort of a simple definition. But actually, part of the point of the book is to showcase institutions that we don't necessarily view as a camp. You know, if I could quote one of my peer reviewers from the book, the peer reviewer said that the narrative swings so rapidly between historical periods that it left my head spinning. and that, I think, is a legitimate concern, but that's also, I think, part of the point. So part of the point is actually to disorient my readers, to shake them out of their complacencies. So I think that when we think of, say, a camp, we tend to think of, say, the Soviet Union, or we might think of Nazi Germany, places like Auschwitz, connected to the Holocaust, and so on. And really, this book, it includes chapters on the Soviet Union and on Nazi Germany and the sort of usual suspects. But it also opens up the history of camps much more broadly to consider episodes of what I call mass confinement, the extrajudicial detention of categories of people in controlled spaces in Canada, in the United States, in Australia, in Africa, in China, and elsewhere. So it really is a broad canvas with many diverse camps that can be fit within that overriding rubric.
In thinking about it, though, is there a requirement in the way you're defining them for there to be an element of, say, coercion or force to be applied? Because I'm thinking of even cases of, not even necessarily, but could include, say, refugee camps, but also after a natural disaster, people tend to gather in camps. So, say, after an earthquake or something, like where people are gathering together and there's no coercion there. They're coming together for humanitarian reasons in a situation like that. Would that qualify on the way you are defining them? Because in those cases, I'm seeing preventative measure in an emergency. I think an earthquake and people coming together after that would certainly qualify.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right. So chapter 8 of the book, the final chapter, is all about the history of refugee camps. The title of that chapter is Humanitarian Containment. And basically, you know, the argument is that concentration camps, which are, I think, a well-known kind of symbol of violence and coercion, concentration camps and refugee camps, in a sense, sort of the flip side of the same coin. They are two, I guess, cousins of a related phenomenon. And actually, they bear a genealogical origin. So the first time that the word concentration camp was used, this was in South Africa during the Anglo-Boer War at the turn of the 19th century. The first time that the word concentration camp was used, it was interchangeable with the word refugee camp. In fact, the term concentration camp and refugee camp were interchangeable largely up until World War II, when Nazi violence sort of changed our associations and connotations of the term concentration camp. And so refugee camps, yes, they do exist to provide humanitarian aid, to shelter, protect, provide food for displaced populations. But something that the chapter on refugee camps argues is that refugee management is itself highly coercive. Refugees are often detained in camps so that they can be surveilled, so that they can be classified, processed, so that they can be controlled. Refugees are often cast, rhetorically speaking, as being undesirable, as potentially dangerous. There is often a association between the refugee who is a victim of, say, terrorism, or economic crisis, as an association between a refugee as you know, being connected with terrorism or with economic crisis. Though they're victims, they're sometimes seen as potential perpetrators too. Mm-hmm. Refugees are often seen as suspects who we don't want in the broader community. A poll done in Jordan in September 2012, I believe it was, confirmed that 80% of the Jordanian population wanted Syrian refugees to be detained within camps because they were seen as potentially dangerous. They would destabilize the host nation and so on. And so often, you know, refugee camps have more in common with other forms of coercive camps than we perhaps like to consider.
Does that create, though, potentially in the reader, an equivalence across camps? Or maybe there is an equivalence that you certainly talk about there is coercive elements to it. And maybe the lived experience for those there isn't that different from, say, the concentration camps or surveillance camps during the Second World War around the world, not just obviously the camp like Auschwitz has a different element to it than perhaps other places, but those sorts of camps that are there to surveil people versus those humanitarian ones, does it create an equivalence for, say, your readers or people who are studying this that, I don't know, maybe it is fair, maybe it isn't fair, but the idea that they're like, how do we get to the nuance of the lived experience of what's going on in these camps, given the differing reasons for their establishment and, of course, the geographic and temporal differences amongst everything that you're studying?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a excellent question. And I think it's one of the real struggles when you are putting together a book that is this broad in its synthesis. You know, the goal of history often is to provide nuance and complexity. But when we write a kind of transnational or a global history, we also have to think about similarities, think about continuities across time and place. And whenever you write a global history like this, you necessarily, I think, have to simplify certain elements of each case that you're looking at. Otherwise, you know, this is a 200-page book. It could be 2,000 pages. We wanted to delve into all of the complexity. But something that I hope comes across is that we shouldn't make facile equivalencies between different types of camps. In fact, the point of the book is to showcase the diversity of different types of camps across world history, rather than to say every single camp is exactly the same. And I think there's something that we need to keep in mind, and I hope it's something that comes across in the book, is that the image of the camp is powerful. That sort of vivid image of barbed wire and watchtowers and so on, I think is one of the presiding images of kind of the dark side of the 20th century. And that image can be put to potent political use. And so if you look at, say, someone like Adolf Hitler, in the early stages of World War II, when he was assembling, I think, the worst regime of camps in world history, a regime that I say in the book is without any sort of equivalent. When you look at Hitler, he very much was thinking about and discussing earlier precedents, and he himself was making equivalencies between them. And so one of the most viewed propaganda films in Nazi Germany was called Om Kruger. And this film took place at a British concentration camp in colonial Africa during the Anglo-Boer War in the year 1900. And the camp and the camp depicted in this film in some ways bears a resemblance to the concentration camps of the Anglo-Boer War, but in many other ways is, you know, depicts total fabrications like a massacre at the hands of a commandant who bears a striking resemblance to Winston Churchill, you know, that just never happened. And so, you know, you can see that the Nazis were using the similarities between these two systems as a form of propaganda. The Chinese government has done something similarly, you know, faced with criticism about the concentration of ethnic Uyghurs in Western China in camps, the potential genocide of the Uyghurs in camps. The Chinese government made explicit reference to Canadian residential schools.
Yes.
And, you know, there are, I have to say, some disturbing similarities between residential schools, residential boarding schools in Canada and what's happening in China. But I think that there are also some important differences as well. And if there are lessons to the history of camps, one of them that comes across, and maybe it's a little bit quotidian and maybe it's a little bit quaint, but one of the lessons that does come across is that democracy actually matters. On the one hand, many different political regimes, from liberal democracies up to totalitarian dictatorships, have turned to camps in one form or another to deal with unwanted, problematic populations. But what we see is that in liberal democracies that have an open, free press, that have a thriving civil society, there are voices of resistance that are able to protest in public, discuss in public the coercion and the violence that encampment entails, and are often able to stem abuses. Whereas in authoritarian regimes, often political dissidence is silenced. People who disagree with the regime are not deemed patriots, they're deemed internal enemies. And as a result, the camps of authoritarian regimes often are much more brutal. They engage in heavier disciplinary regimes, harsher work, more strident forms of physical punishment, and so on. I don't want to say that, you know, Japanese internment camps, say in the United States, were in any way humane organizations. Quite the opposite. They were horrendous implements of racial coercion. But, you know, the United States had a system of checks and balances, even during the environment of World War II, had a legal system that was able to ultimately protest the extrajudicial confinement of a group defined by its race. And the camps never engaged in sort of explicit genocide in the way the Nazi camps did, and were eventually shut down and then remembered as a blot on American history. And so, you know, democracy and open dissent, I think, really do make a difference. And you see this chapter after chapter in this book, or at least I hope you do.
Right. But then I'm curious, in a democracy where something like Japanese internment is going on during the Second World War, the question then becomes about information and messaging to the public. Like, how does the information in a democracy get from the camp and what's going on to the public in a way that there can be action? Because you see it with residential schools. We've had on the show a book about the newspapers that residential schools were putting out, and they were all very positive and all the kids were doing great and there was no abuse at all. So the messaging from the state and the people running the camps would still, I imagine, be this is all for good, for positive purpose. So how does that translate in a democracy where, in my mind, the messaging coming out of the place would still be the same, but if there's actual action from dissent on the outside, I'm just wondering how that relationship works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's right. I think that propaganda exists in democracies as well. I think that democracies sometimes, because the conversation is more open, can have an easier time identifying propaganda and labeling it publicly and condemning it publicly as propaganda. So I don't want to in any way minimize the potential of coercion in democratic societies. But it is more open. Another example would be going back to colonial times at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. During the Anglo-Boer War, when the term concentration camp was coined, there were a set of British dissidents, women largely, who traveled from Britain to South Africa, were able to tour the camps and publicize their findings. They were very critical of the British government. The British government tried to portray them as sort of hysterical women who were kind of, you know, fabricating lies about what was actually going on. But in the end, it made a difference. Ultimately, the government realized that there was a substantial constituent of the British public that was opposed to these camps, and they made substantial improvements to the living conditions of these camps, to the shelter and the food and the hygiene available at them, and ultimately tried to deconcentrate them as quickly as they could. Now, you can compare that to colonial Germany in Southwest Africa just a couple years later. The Kaiserreich, as it was called, the German colonial regime in what is today Namibia, faced a colonial uprising of the Nama and Herero people, and they placed them in concentration camps, largely, you know, following British precedent. There was a lot of learning and communication between the two colonies. But the German political culture was quite different. It was, I think, inconceivable in a sort of militarized society like early 20th century Germany for political dissidents, in particular women, to travel to Africa to publicize crimes being committed by the military. And as a result, what you see is that in South Africa, in British South Africa, I don't want to in any way say that these were benign institutions. They killed a lot of people, largely through the spread of epidemic diseases and so on. But nonetheless, in British South Africa, reforms were made, and any sort of potential genocidal impulses to these camps were quickly put in check. In Southwest Africa, on the other hand, there was no public outcry. Certainly not. There were people who tried, but there was no public outcry as great as in Britain. And as a result, these camps became instruments of genocide. The death rate in them was much, much higher than in South Africa. Both systems are evil blots on humanity, but there is nonetheless some nuance there as well. And, you know, politics do play a role in that.
Now, you mentioned there a bunch of different examples, and you mentioned earlier the comment you got from one of the peer reviewers that you go around everywhere and it's fast-paced and a lot of things are going on. But I'm, of course, curious as to how you did that, just from a methodological perspective, to be able to go around the world, different camps at different times. Just how did you conduct the research, and how were you able to put it all together into a 200-page book?
Yeah, it was challenging. Yeah. the my interest in camps stems from, when I was a graduate student. First book, which arose out of my PhD dissertation, was very much a deep dive based on archival research. And so my first book, it was called Barbed Wire Imperialism, Britain's Empire of Camps. And this was largely about the Anglo-Boer War, where the term concentration camp was coined, but it went further back in time as well. So it looked at moments of colonial emergency, particularly in India, where during massive famines in the 1870s and the 1890s, the British colonial regime gathered famine refugees into camps where they put them to heavy labor in return for rations. There was an outbreak of bubonic plague in the 1890s, which led to quarantine camps. Anyone who was suspected of carrying disease, which in that environment meant basically any impoverished colonial person, was placed as a preemptive measure into a quarantine camp. And I looked in that book at the process of transnational, transimperial interchange between South Africa and India. We see, the logistics of how to manage a camp were emerging in this sort of transnational connected way across the Indian Ocean. Now, that book, of course, was, I guess you could call it a scholarship of discovery. I was looking at brand new archives. I was opening up primary source material, largely in English, which nobody had really looked at before. Now, this book is quite different. I might refer to it as sort of a scholarship of synthesis more than of discovery. And actually, the book emerged out of my teaching. So I teach at McEwen University in Canada, and I've taught several classes on the global history of camps. And it seemed to me that we needed a way to talk about all of these many different case studies in a in a single book, in a single frame of reference. And so that's what sort of was the impetus for this book. In terms of conducting the research, you know, I think that sometimes we view historians as being these solitary figures working alone in dusty archives and so on. But actually, you know, this book wouldn't be possible without the incredibly rich and sophisticated scholarship that has been written by other historians, specialists in many different fields. So I don't, you know, I can read German at a very rudimentary level, but not well enough to do original research in German archives. I don't read Russian, so I was unable to, you know, perform original research in Russia. I don't read Chinese either. But there is enough that has been written on each of these cases that I'm able to piece together a sufficient narrative based on largely secondary sources. And one of the features of the book is that it includes an annotated bibliography at the back. And the hope is that readers of the book, if they are interested in you know, the information in a particular chapter, a particular episode, can find further resources. So the book is synthetic in nature, but I also hope that it is original. It's not just summarizing what other people have written, but it's putting it together in ways that haven't been put together, in ways that, that haven't been done in the past. So I hope the book is more than the sum of its parts. I hope that a specialist of Nazi Germany can rethink what they know about Nazi concentration camps once those camps are placed in a longer and more global narrative.
You mentioned that you don't read Russian or Chinese, rudimentary on the German side. Does that create a scenario, though, where you are being potentially over-reliant on the English language literature? And how do you ensure that you are getting material from a variety of linguistic sources, given that the times and the places that you're writing about take place all over the world with a bunch of different language groups?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. it's difficult. I think that, again, you know, scholarship is collaborative in nature. And so one of the early impetuses for this book was a conference I was invited to on the Soviet Gulag. The conference brought together, you know, people who were specialists in Soviet history who spoke Russian, and it included several scholars from Russia who were working within the Russian Academy and of course, doing all of their scholarship in Russian. And so exchanges like that, I think, were very useful in learning about the Soviet Gulag in a way that isn't, you know, confined to a Western English language perspective. Same for China. You know, some of the research that has been done in China is astonishing. You know, there's an anthropologist, Darren Beiler is his name, at Simon Fraser University, who has done basically ethnographic research in Western China, interviewing victims of Uyghur concentration camps. And so, you know, that material is invaluable because it translates the views of indigenous Uyghur peoples in the west of China into a mode that's accessible to me and then that is incorporated into the book. So I think the answer to that question is I've relied on the expertise and generosity of a wide variety of scholars. And in a sense, you know, although I'm the author of this book and I've put it together and, you know, all of the faults are, of course, my responsibility, you know, the book is a communal, collective, collaborative effort in many ways.
In a similar vein, what about questions related to cultural norms and just general culture around the world, where sometimes you could get potentially confusion across cultures where either the group that's being confined or the group that is confining might be engaging in a certain behavior that fits within a cultural norm for them, but is not for the other side, and that creates more conflict or more tension. Is there, or are there examples of that in the book where you see that there are questions of cultural norms or practices that are engaged in a camp that are misunderstood or misinterpreted by one side or the other?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, one of the goals of the book is to show how different cultures, on the one hand, are different, but they're also connected. And so one of the connective tissues of the book is to show a kind of transnational learning process from one place to another. And so one example of this is China, which has, of course, its own culture and its own traditions and history quite different from the West, but which also in the 20th century becomes integrated into a larger kind of Western economic economic system. And so in the 20th century, China borrows the concept of the concentration camp from the West. It starts with prisons rather than camps. You know, there are kind of Western prison reformers who are traveling through China, and China is actively learning from the West, often via the conduit of Japan, which is even more kind of interested in Western precedents. And so if you look at, say, the Beijing prison number one, which is an artifact of the early 20th century, it kind of is a cultural fusion of different traditions. The Beijing prison attempted to reform inmates in the same way that, you know, Pentonville in London, for example, did. At the lectern in one of the rooms in the Beijing prison, one of the communal rooms, there was a portrait of Confucius and Lao Tzu, two Chinese thinkers, as well as Jesus and Muhammad, and of John Howard, who was a British prison reformer. And so you see these kind of fascinating moments of, I guess, cultural syncretism, where you get kind of a blending of East and West. Chiang Kai-shek, who was the nationalist leader of China, actively sought inspiration from Japan and also from Germany when he was interning communist suspects during the Chinese Civil War. And one of the camps that he created, it was called Xinfeng, he referred to as a Confucian concentration camp. And it had a real emphasis on, I guess, thought reform. There is, I think, a long-standing principle in Chinese traditional culture dating to Confucius and Mencius and so on, that the human being is malleable, and that, like trees blowing in the wind, wayward individuals need to bend towards the group. And so this proved quite compatible with Western modes of managing populations in camps. Mao Zedong, who then replaced Chiang Kai-shek as the leader of China, you know, retains that cultural emphasis on molding, on reforging wayward individuals within the camps towards a sort of group conformity. But instead of inviting German advisors, he invites Soviet advisors to help him set up his own system of camps. And so I think that we see, on the one hand, individual cultures adopting camps and assimilating a larger set of global practices to its own ends, to make sense within its own cultural milieu. But we also see, I think, a larger culture of confinement that spreads across the globe in the 19th and 20th centuries. For most of recorded human history, deviant populations were not placed in camps. They were executed, they were exiled overseas, but they weren't confined. The idea of confining them in some sort of demarcated institution is a cultural practice that circulates globally in the 19th and 20th centuries and is adopted by many different cultures.
Why did that change? That's a really interesting point. Why go from exiling people or executing people to confining them? What prompted that change across the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a few kind of there's a few reasons. Some of them are ironic. I mean, one is that camps offer a humanitarian alternative to wholesale slaughter, which isn't right to say that the 20th century hasn't engaged in wholesale slaughter. But, you know, there is a sort of Enlightenment era humanitarian sentiment that approaches human beings as capable of change and of reform. There's sort of, you know, the politics of the 18th and the 19th centuries, I think, very much emphasizes the agency of human societies and their ability to change society for the better. And that may involve excluding deviant populations, in order to change, reform, or assimilate them. And so in some ways, execution by the 18th and 19th centuries is seen as increasingly kind of problematic. And then exile as well is seen as problematic. Why should you exile a population when you can control and change it internally? And the other thing about exile is that the world's frontiers closed off by the late 19th century. You know, the British used to exile its deviant populations to the United States, and then the United States became independent and they requested, can you please stop sending convicts to us? So, they switched to Australia, and then Australia by the late 19th century, also as it became more independent, adopted self-governance, sort of closed off its continent as a place to warehouse unwanted populations. And so there's sort of a practical reason there as well.
Right. Is there a business case, an economic case that, and maybe I'm just too in the, you know, I've been reading a lot about the United States recently and the for-profit prison system, but it strikes me that around the world, people have probably made a lot of money off confining other human beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's quite right. And the book very much views camps in this kind of broad and long durée perspective. So chapter two, for example, largely engages with the history of transatlantic slavery. And it suggests that the slave plantation itself was a form of camp that detained a population that was defined largely on the basis of its race. This was a population that hadn't, you know, done anything, that hadn't committed a crime or anything, that was confined because of who they were rather than anything they had done. And of course, the plantation is a form of forced labor. And I think that you see forced labor as one of these connective threads that stitches together many of the different camps discussed in this book. So, you know, I think Auschwitz was largely a slave labor camp in Nazi Germany. The Soviet Gulag, although it was in many ways economically irrational, was nonetheless a system of forced labor that was quite important to the functioning of the Soviet economy. And you see in the United States today, the prison industrial complex, in many ways leases out convicts to a what you might call planter class of corporations at subsidized and therefore socialized submarket rates to perform unskilled labor. And there is a continuity there, I think. If you read a book by Michelle Alexander, for example, The New Jim Crow, you can see that there are historical continuities between the plantation and the current American prison complex, which detains racial minorities in disproportionate numbers, and which also detains as many convicts per capita as the Soviet Gulag did under Stalin.
So in thinking about it in that sense and listening to that answer, are camps an inevitable result of whether it's, you want to say, political, economic, or social structures, or just a part of just human existence, given that they are so universal and that they've happened around the world across culture, across time? Is this just part of what human beings do to each other?
Well, so the book, although it takes a long durée perspective, only stretches back 200 years. And so humanity has existed for the vast majority of its existence without putting people in camps, which isn't to say it hasn't committed other forms of violence. I see camps very much as sort of a ubiquitous feature of modern statecraft. And so I think that there are some key ingredients that are necessary. There's some key preconditions that are necessary in order for regimes to create camps. One is, I think, a fairly sophisticated bureaucracy. Just logistically speaking, it's difficult to concentrate vast numbers in demarcated institutions without sort of a professional bureaucracy. I think another is the sort of revolutionary politics of the that develops in the 18th and 19th centuries that, again, views human societies as something malleable, something capable of being reforged, often through a certain amount of violence. And so I think that once we enter the 19th and into the 20th centuries, we see such a vast array of regimes turning to camps that I think that there is something quite fundamental, perhaps not about human nature, but at least about how human societies have developed in the last couple hundred years that make camps. I don't want to ever say that something is inevitable. There's always human agency. Camps are at base a human story, and there's many people who bear witness to the crimes of camps, who resist camps, and so on. So I don't want to say it's inevitable, but it does seem to be common, and it does seem to be, with the right preconditions in place, it does seem to be quite likely that we create camps, which isn't to say all camps are the same. There's many differences between them. But the act of warehousing problematic groups in a demarcated enclosure has become, unfortunately, very common.
In that sense, is the book, does it serve almost as a warning for people or something that you can look at wherever you live or the communities that you're involved in, or just to be aware of what's going on around the world? Like, if I'm picking up the book and reading it as somebody who isn't a social scientist and is just curious about the idea of camps and these themes that you have identified, what should they be looking out for, and what would the motivation for them be in looking at a book like this?
Yeah, I think it should be a warning. And I think it should be an urgent one as well, because, in many ways, the 20th century was the century of camps, but that doesn't mean the 21st century might not be as well. And one of, I guess, the thematic threads that, again, ties together some of these chapters, the kind of the cultural perceptions that lead to camps in the first place. The sociologist Zygmunt Bauman identified two kind of prevailing metaphors of what he calls the type of statecraft that led to the Holocaust. One was the language of medicine. And so whenever we hear powerful people talking about certain groups of people in epidemiological terms, that they are infectious, that they are a disease, that, the Chinese government calls the Uyghurs in Western China malignant tumors. Whenever we hear language about, certain groups of people infecting the body politic, I think that we should be on guard. Another defining metaphor that often leads to camps is that of gardening. Whenever we see certain people describe other populations as weeds, as noxious elements that need to be eradicated, again, I think we can see danger. We can see warnings. The language of war as well is, I think, really prominent. Throughout the book, we often see that camps are the products of war. Sometimes they're, guerrilla insurgencies. So we see at the end of the 19th, early 20th centuries in the Anglo-Boer War and Cuba and the Philippines and so on, camps often emerge as forms of kind of occupying an unruly society in the context of war. And of course, we can't understand Nazi concentration camps or Japanese internment camps without the context of war. But sometimes the war can be more rhetorical than real. And so whenever we talk about, for example, the war on terror, this is quite an amorphous concept. But it can lead to violations of human rights. It can lead to extrajudicial detention at places like Guantanamo. The Chinese state very much refers to its Muslim minorities as potential insurgents in a people's war on terror. Whenever we talk about the war on drugs, for example, I think that we can see the turn to coercive mechanisms to detain people. Whenever we talk about the country being invaded by migrants, that kind of thing, these are words that are, these are concepts, these are phrases that are used throughout the global history of camps. And when we hear that type of language, that type of rhetorical framing in the present, I think we should be we should be concerned.
It's very well said, and a very good reason for people to pick up the book. So again, it is Camps, A Global History of Mass Confinement. Aiden, if people want to pick up a copy of the book or keep up with everything else you got going, your other book, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, I hate to say it, but probably Amazon. Yeah. Or go to the University of Toronto's website as well, and you might get a discount there.
There you go. And we will link to the U of T post where the book is in the show notes below. So check it out down there. And again, Aiden, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So there you have it, my chat with Aiden Forth. I thank him again for his time. And the book, again, is Camps, A Global History of Mass Confinement. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from NPR, a story from Nurith Eizeman, which was originally heard on All Things Considered, entitled What World War II Taught Us About How to Help Starving People Today. And the article starts by talking about Allied forces as they liberated concentration camps that were run by the Nazis, and how American and British soldiers really rushed to feed people, given that they were starving to death, and the dismay that many of them had that as they were providing food to these individuals, a lot of them died. And that is because that their bodies had been so starved that their biological functions were just thrown so out of whack, and they couldn't handle eating as regularly as you would without being starved. And the article gets into what researchers have gotten into since then, the study of malnutrition, and how if you are in a situation where you have been starved, like in concentration camps, how a person can come back from that and how it has to be progressive to start eating again. And as I was reading this article, I reflected on what Aiden and I talked about in terms of the damage that's done in these camps and how inhumane they can be. And within that, how ubiquitous they are at the same time. And it's a very powerful indication of the callousness that human beings can show towards each other. So while this article in and of itself is not necessarily about camps, that its starting point was concentration camps from the Second World War really made me reflect that we have to do these studies, or scientists are doing these studies on starvation, on malnutrition, because the reality exists that people are malnourished and are starving. And sometimes that is due to economic conditions, agricultural conditions, certainly colonial power structures, all play into these factors. While at the same time, the concentration of human beings is still happening. And malnutrition, starvation in places of concentration, in places of confinement, is still a reality. So these studies, and again, in this case, born out of concentration camps in the Second World War, still very relevant in terms of a lot of the issues that we talked about with Aiden today. So the article, again, I wasn't necessarily looking for this article for the purposes of the historical headline of the week. I just came across it, and it really stuck out to me that a lot of what is included in here is certainly relevant to questions and discussions related to concentration and confinement. So definitely recommend you take a look at this article written by Nurith Eizeman from April 19, 2024, originally heard on All Things Considered on NPR, What World War II Taught Us About How to Help Starving People Today. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, like, rate, comment. All that good stuff helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. And head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there, plus all the great written material there on the website. And of course, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's oldest news at gmail.com. So thanks again so much for listening. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Oldest News.